while you're getting yourself into your seat there, I just wanted to remind you that we've made this resource available for you, Saving Grace. It's a daily devotional for those of you who want to spend 2016 going day by day, nourishing your own inner life, your own spirit, with good gospel grace and truth. And we sell these at the Welcome Wall for less than we pay for them. We don't make any money on them. We want you to have them. So if you don't have the money to buy one of these, just nudge someone near you and say, "Can I borrow $15? It's urgent. My soul depends on it." And but hopefully before you go, you find those, and I hope it's useful. Hope you find it useful and nourishing, and also I hope it's encouraging that there's a lot of other people who are going through that same daily devotional. So we have been talking together about who we are. The past 2 weeks, we recognize and acknowledge that when Jesus starts to imagine who we are and he starts to shape us by the gospel and he sets us aside, he doesn't set us aside as a place. Church is not a destination, it's not a location, it's a family. And we talked last week about what it takes for the family to experience peace, and that is for all of God's family to take on the responsibility to be peacemakers. And today we're going to look at another aspect of who we are, speaking in terms of our identity as God's church, and trying to deal with the question, who are the real Christians? Who are they? Are they the moral majority? Are they the religious right in the political circles? Are they the ones who are the Bible thumpers or the churchgoers? Who are the Christians? One person described it this way to me. They said, "I've just been so disappointed because you can't even tell who the Christians are anymore." I said, "Yeah, I don't even know exactly what you mean." They said, "Well, I mean, look at those people. You would never know that they were Christians because this world is, the Christians are dressing like the world now." And I thought to myself, I don't know where Jesus tackles that specifically, but the question is, where are the Christians? What do the Christians look like? Who are the Christians? And here's what we learn in the scriptures, that we are the servants. That the Christian family, that God's people have been shaped and set aside by the gospel and faith in Jesus, and he crafts a family who becomes servants, who live their life as missionaries and make disciples. And that's who we are. And we will tackle that today based on the way that Jesus teaches us about servanthood. And he does so in Matthew 20. He's got his disciples around him and he's given them a crash course, doctorate level teaching on leadership. How many of you have ever been to a leadership class? Anybody ever been to a leadership class or a little seminar, institute, training, conference where they teach you the principles of leadership, and when you walk away, here's the idea, that you're better prepared to be a leader. Jesus brings his disciples nearby and says, here's bad leadership, here's good leadership, let me show you godly leadership. And gives you a vivid doctorate level course in what leadership looks like. Matthew chapter 20, verses 25 to 28, Jesus calls them together and he says, "You know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must become your slave. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many." And so what Jesus is saying here is that I have people, and you will recognize my people because they'll be the ones serving. They will be the ones giving their lives. They will be the ones living a lifestyle of serving. In particular, he says, we, the people of God, are servants of God who serve others, and we do so as a way of life. It is our lifestyle. It's the way we live. It's the approach in which we live our lives as people who belong to God and have been set apart. I don't know if I ever told you the story about the time I met a woman who was nicknamed the Queen. I found out later why. I was in a group of people, and I was kind of mingling around from person to person, and I noticed that there was somebody waiting for me in the corner of my eye, and it took quite some time to finally get to her, and when I got to her, she said, "Well, it's about time." I'm going to quote her, okay? She said, "I wasn't quite sure that you noticed I was here." I said, "Man, she must be super important." Well, she told me that she was. She went on to explain all the ways in which she was known, all the way in which really important people knew her. She went on to explain to me how important she was as a pastor's wife and a missionary, and all the ways that I should have known that she is well connected and well known. But one of the things that really struck me is when we were about ready to part ways, I stuck my hand out and I said, "Well, it's a pleasure meeting you." I lied right to her face. It's a habit. I was just a habit. But I reached my hand out to shake her hand, and she took my hand. This has never happened to me before, never happened to me since. And she twisted my hand right up to her mouth, to my mouth. She twisted her hand right up to my mouth for me to kiss it. Now, here's the shape of my hand. I do this handshake. She turns my hand, so her hand's laying over mine, and she leans her hand into my lips. How many of you think I kissed her hand? Raise your hand if you think I kissed her hand. In a moment of brilliant, spirit-led wisdom, I took my left hand, I put it on top of her hand, and I just patted it, and I gave her hand back to her. And I decided that she's going to need this hand for the mayor and the president or whoever else she's meeting that she wants to kiss her hand. Later on, I was explaining with someone that I had this encounter with somebody, and they said, "Yeah, we're familiar with her. We've nicknamed her the Queen." And I am teasing her. But we've all met people who are a little too self-important. Sometimes we work for these people. They're our boss. Sometimes we marry these people. They're our wives, not our husbands. They're our wives. Sometimes we work near these people. Sometimes these people pull us over at a traffic stop. Sometimes these people have gavels and they're making judgments. And sometimes these people are politicians. And they have become too self-important. And in their leadership role and in their leadership position, we have found ourselves being forced to following self-promoting leaders. And I think we've all met them. We've all had power-hungry leaders, bosses, and authority figures. Some of the ones who make us so tense that we can't relax until they leave the room, or we feel like they only notice us when they need us. Or in some cases, they've taken credit for our idea. They've taken credit for our results, but they have scooped in and they have promoted themselves by taking. Some people even say this is what's happening with Donald Trump. He is well respected by some by being a forceful straight talker. Other people see him as a billionaire bully who is taking a hold of the presidency for his own gain and whatever. I don't know Donald Trump. I don't know what his motives are. I don't even care to tell you what I think of him. Here's what I do mean to say. It's not just politicians and billionaires whose heart is hungry for power, authority, and position, and oftentimes can't handle it, and can't handle it well. It's not just those people that we see or those people that we have been overrun by, but also church leaders are just as vulnerable to this particular appetite that our heart has for powerful positions. You may have come across the church culture where the pastor and the pastor's wife are expected that people, all people in their church family, refer to them as the man of God and the first lady. I would never call my wife the first lady, ever. That's so ridiculous. Now, the man of God part, I could get used to that. I'm just trying to be honest with you. But what kind of culture, listen, oh, this is going to be so self-righteous. I'm not going to say that. It was going to be self-righteous. Our hearts like that when we have positions of authority and power to be referred to be recognized, and to otherwise be honored as the leader. And so that explains why when you have something in the church family called the culture of honor that's sweeping across our country, I guess it has been for quite some time, the culture of honor within it, don't you think we ought to honor each other? I really think we should. I think we should honor people as made in the image of God and honor people to be a source of encouragement and care for people. But when honor goes too far, you can call it a culture of honor, but the honor doesn't go from the leaders to the followers. The honor is supposed to go from the follower to the leader. Someone told me a story one time that they were interning at a church and they were serving the pastor in a culture of honor. And at 2:30 in the morning, they received a phone call and thought it was urgent and emergency. It was the pastor that they were serving at this big church, and in the culture of honor, of course, they knew they better pick up this phone. And the pastor said, hey, the car's in my driveway. The keys are in it. I want you to wash the car. Later on, the pastor, 2:30 in the morning. Later on, the pastor instructed this young intern that it was a test to measure their willingness to serve. And I thought to myself, if you want to teach serving, call your intern at 2:30 in the morning and say, where's your car? Where's your keys? I'm going to go wash it for you. And then your intern says, this is what leadership looks like. It's in our church family. It's in our pastors' hearts. It's in our leadership hearts. And here's why. Because our hearts have a problem. That is that we have an appetite for self-promotion. We have an appetite for positions of leadership and authority. Our human hearts are so easily seduced by leadership, power, and position that starts as a young person when we're just toddlers. We start getting in our parents' faces and saying, look at me. Mama, watch this. Daddy, watch this. Mama, watch me. Look at me. Watch me. Look at me. Watch me. Look at me. I've had bad experiences. I'm traumatized. 4 times. And what we discover is that right in the bones of a child is this desire to be noticed and recognized and seen and paid attention to. And it's cute, isn't it? It's cute until they never grow out of it. It's cute until we become adults and we have the same life-controlling desire to have powerful positions, to have people respect our authority, and for us to have all kinds of restlessness in our heart to be noticed and to use and be recognized with power. And many people take this life-driving appetite all the way into their position of authority. Now, here's the problem. By the way, you've got notes in your hand. It's going to be a while before we get to that first fill-in-the-blank, okay? So some of you, I see you. You're already biting your nails and looking at your nails like, when's the blank coming? This guy just won't shut his mouth and fill in the blank. It's going to be a while, but we're going to get there. Jesus teaches, listen, he teaches extensively about the positions of authority. And let me tell you what he basically says. You want a doctorate level course in Jesus' leadership teaching? Here it is. The first in his kingdom, the first will be last. And the last shall be what? That's essentially what Jesus says, is that those who elevate themselves will be brought low, but those who bring themselves low, God will bring them up. Starting with bringing yourself low enough to repent of your own sin that separates you from God and putting your trust in Jesus. That's the beginning point of making yourself low. But all the talk that Jesus is doing with his disciples about the first being last starts to worry two of the disciples' mother. James and John have a mom. She's referred to as a mother of the sons of Zebedee. And she starts to get really tense as Jesus is talking about all of the important disciples are going to be last, and then all the unimportant ones are going to be first. And you can imagine her starting to get concerned for her sons, because they were two of the disciples who began to follow him first. And Jesus is teaching that it's wrong to expect God to reward his disciples with positions of honor. Now, don't we all have a story of our mom kind of embarrassing us with a teacher or a coach or someone? I remember when my dad told one of my baseball coaches that he was concerned that he was overlooking my talent. And my coach, I'm sure my coach said back to him, we're not overlooking it, we don't see it. There isn't, we don't see any, there is no talent. But don't we all kind of have a story where our mom introduced us to somebody and told them how great we were? How fantastic we were, and how we ought to know them and know our child. And thank God for moms that sometimes lose their bearings and think that we're so terrific. But this is what's happening. Jesus has disciples, James and John, and their mother gets involved with Jesus, and they're all together. And the mother kneels next to Jesus and says, look, I just wanted to kind of put this out there. I mean, you don't have to do this. You are the Son of God. You can do whatever you want. And I know you've probably recognized that my sons are kind of important. I mean, you're omniscient and everything. But listen, when it's all said and done, when you sit down, I wonder if you would consider letting one of my sons sit on your right hand and one of my other sons sit on your left hand. By the way, if you know where Jesus finally sits, he sits at the right hand of the Father when it's all said and done. Who's on Jesus' left hand? Let's do the math. If Jesus sits down at the right hand of the Father, who's on Jesus' left hand at the end? Yeah. God the Father, right? So she doesn't really know what she's saying. But here's what she's saying. My sons have served you. They've honored you. They've been obedient, probably more obedient than the rest of these knuckleheads that I've been kind of keeping an eye on. So if you elevated them, I would understand it. I mean, it would make sense to me. And here's what Jesus says. Mom, you don't know what you're asking. You don't really know what you're asking. And she, can you imagine her saying, oh, yes, I do. By the way, she had just asked this after Jesus for the third time announced that he was going to die a criminal's death via crucifixion on a cross. He had just announced for the third time, hey, by the way, I don't know if this is stuck yet. I don't know if you've caught this yet, but the innocent one, the Son of God, is going to die a death of a criminal on the cross for those of you who are guilty, and I'm completely innocent, but that's the way it's going to go. And the mother of James and John are like, yeah, right. So anyway, about my sons, what I wanted to know, just passed right by it. Passed right by it. And Jesus tells her, you don't know what you're asking. And here's why he said that. He said, you don't know what you're asking. Because if you want a place of honor, you're going to have to live how I live, but also you're going to have to die like I die. And Jesus says, your sons, if they want to be elevated, they're going to have to drink a bitter cup of suffering. And can you imagine them? By now they're all together and they're listening to Jesus teach, and he's saying, if you want to follow me and you want to be elevated the way I'm elevated, you're going to have to drink a bitter cup of suffering. Can you imagine them just saying, yeah, that's okay. As long as this means that we're kind of promoted at the end or recognized at the end, that's okay. In fact, bitter cup of suffering, I'll take two of those. I don't care what it is. And Jesus is trying to tell them, you don't really know what you're asking. This is going to cost you your life. If you want to serve me and you want to obey me, it's not a situation where you're asked to elevate yourself. You're asked to lower yourself. And then in the end, God will sort out who gets awarded and who gets rewarded. And their hearts, after all this time spent with Jesus, listen to this. If you haven't caught leadership yet and what it really means for you and your life and your lifestyle, it's okay. These men spent 3 years at least knowing about, serving, following, and hearing about Jesus, and they still had not caught what leadership was. Their hearts were still so full of self-promotion. They were so easily seduced by a leadership power and leadership position. They still had the wrong idea of what leadership greatness is. And what Jesus does to teach them is he says, think of the leaders that you know. Think of the rulers and the authorities that you're familiar with, and think of the way they use their leadership. They lord their authority over people. The officials flaunt their authority over the followers. In fact, Jesus is kind of describing what some of us have experienced with worldly leaders, leaders who care for you so they can coerce you. To motivate you, they're willing to manipulate you. And other leaders who very specifically abuse their authority in order to get what they want, to protect themselves, they're willing to abuse their authority over you. And Jesus says, the leaders in this world abuse their authority. They'll prove their point, and just to prove their point, they'll punish you. Have you ever been around a coworker, boss, or otherwise a leader who, to prove their point, is willing to punish you? To coerce you, they're willing to give you a little care. They pay attention to you in order to eventually to coerce you and motivate and manipulate you. Now, you may have, if you're a student of culture, you may have noticed that there's a series that has kind of taken our pop culture by storm called Making a Murderer. It's a Netflix original documentary series, and the premise of this series, I'm going to save you from watching it. Okay, I'm going to give you back, listen, right here, right now, I'm going to give you back 10 hours of your life. Listen close. Here's the premise of the documentary. Somebody who didn't deserve it was abused and punished by people who have authority in the court system and the law enforcement field. Okay, so that's the premise of it, that their power, their positions of power were abused in order to punish somebody that they wanted to lash out and retaliate against. Among Jesus' disciples, here's what he says. When you aspire to leadership, it's not going to go like that. It's not going to be like that. He says that's the way the world's leaders rule. That's the way they use their authority. But among you, if you want to aspire to any kind of leadership, it's going to be the opposite of that. It's going to be completely different. The leaders in God's church will handle their influence differently. The disciples who want to lead you will first serve you. The disciples who want to be first among you, those disciples will become your slave. Christian leaders are different. In the Christian church family, the leadership is different because they never flaunt their high positions. Instead, they always favor their low posture. They take high positions and they reject high positions. They don't need a high position. Instead, what they choose and what they favor is to position themselves in low postures of serving. That's how you identify who these leaders are among the Christian community. And God seriously expects positional leaders to lower their posture and to lose their positions, but to use their positions to serve. Because Jesus himself said, look, if you're having trouble with this concept, my disciples and your mother, if you're having trouble with this, keep this in mind. Even the Son of God, the creator of the universe, who was there as a part of creation, who holds all things together, has lowered himself and has come to serve, not to be served. So Jesus is saying, I am the example. In fact, I'm so committed to this that I did it. I so believe in this that I have actually done it. I have demonstrated for you what it looks like. And Jesus selflessly gives up his privileges and he takes the humble position of what? A slave. This is all written about. Paul writes about this extensively in Philippians. If you get a chance to read Philippians 2, do so, and you'll see Jesus being introduced as the one who was high and lifted up, who did not think that it was equality with God was something to cling to forever. So he divested himself of all of his authority, and he took a low position. And he was so obedient that he didn't just take a low position, he actually took a low position that led him all the way to the cross to die a criminal's death. But he started low, and in the end, this is what God does. He elevates him and he gives him a place of honor at the right hand of the Father. And here's what he says: one day every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that the one who lowered himself like a slave is now the high and lifted up one. And Jesus did that to say, that's why I came. Imagine, can you imagine the kind of wealth and majesty and royalty that Jesus could have acquired for himself while on earth? And if you disagree with him, he doesn't order you to be killed. He just squeezes you or flicks you off of the planet and you fly into the universe where there's no gravity and you just continue to accelerate from this. Kind of graphic, isn't it? I've been watching Star Wars. I have all these new ideas of what it could look like. But Jesus here is the one who could have acquired it, and he doesn't acquire it. He forfeits it, lowers himself, empties himself, gets himself so low they crucify him and kill him. Finally, for a criminal's charges, he's the innocent one dying for those who are guilty and killing him. And God finally says, this is what it looks like. Now I take that low position and I elevate him. Because in my world, in my kingdom, and if you're trying to identify who my people are, that's what it looks like. Jesus expects that among his people, power and authority will be used differently. Differently. And so that means the people who start to earn influence and leadership among God's people, even here at the North Central Church family, are not necessarily given to people who are well-liked. Oh, wouldn't you admit it helps if you want to influence people to be well-liked? It's not necessarily given to people who have the most experience, although wouldn't you admit if you have experience and you're well-liked, it goes a long way to influence people? Yes, of course it does. And it's not necessarily given to the people who are the most heavily gifted, although wouldn't you admit to be gifted, experienced, and well-liked goes a long way? But the people who are given leadership influence, Jesus has made it so clear. And if you think to yourself, I'd like to believe God might be able to use me in leadership somewhere, but I'm not sure what it looks like, Jesus' disciples serve with the same attitude. Jesus' disciples are expected to serve with the same attitude he does. You must have the same attitude that Christ Jesus had. What attitude did Christ Jesus have? Christ Jesus would take a position like this on his knee or however he positioned himself, and he would call the little children to him, or the children would gather around him, and the disciples would say, whoa, 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 whoa. The kids don't sit on the knee of the king. I mean, let's not go crazy. And what did Jesus say? No, 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 no. I'm sure he used King James language, right? He said, suffer the little children unto me. Didn't he use the King James? And then we switched it all around. But Jesus said, let the kids come to me. Let them come and sit on my knee. Let them be with the Creator and the King, because the King who's high and lifted up lowers himself to meet the needs of the children. Someone recently told me of a story that when they were explained to them, I asked the person, I said, how did you find yourself out of God's church? How did you find yourself so in such a distant land in distant country. And he said, I didn't have very good experiences with the church. But he said, in particular, there's one I never forgot where I had a little incident with the pastor. And he went on to tell me the story about how there was a church picnic and all of the church family was out on the softball field. And he said he was in junior high, maybe a little younger than junior high, but right around the junior high age. And he said he was standing behind the backstop with his hands on the screen like this, and he was cheering on the team. Cheering them on. And he said, by the way, I should add that while I was there cheering on the church softball game at the church picnic, all of my nutty friends were out causing trouble somewhere else, but I was there with the church family. And one time he said, I yelled, let's go, brother so-and-so, which was who was the pastor who was pitching. The pastor should always pitch, by the way. I just want to throw that out there. God sets aside pitchers, and oftentimes they're uniquely pastors. Anyway, the pastor's pitching, and he yells, let's go, brother, and he names the pastor. The pastor stops the game. Whoa. Hold on. And he points at this person, and he says, according to this person, I want you to come here. So now everything's stopped. You can imagine how quiet it is. And the little guy comes around the fence like this, and he said, what did you call me? And he said, well, I called you brother, then I named you. And he said, let's get one thing straight. I am not your brother. I will never be your brother. I'm your pastor. And then he closed with this little treat. I don't know who you think you are. And so listen. Do you wonder, does it shock you to hear that this little person began the journey a long ways away from God's church and God's people? And that's just one little church picnic story. These positions of leadership and authority are to be dealt with delicacy. And if, by the way, I'm not quite sure that pastor was following Jesus, because Jesus said, suffer these little children, bring all the kids to me, and let me honor them. And we have a responsibility to handle and demonstrate our positions of leadership and authority well, and to do so the way Jesus did. And when Jesus says, or when Paul is writing to the church at Philippi, and he says, you who are believers, who belong to the church, who trust Jesus, must have the same attitude as Christ Jesus, he's talking about being able to bear the image of God well for people to be really, really attracted to who God is. Not attracted to who we are. And this makes it pretty easy to identify people who are genuinely might not be following Jesus because they're abusive in their positions of authority, or they take their power and they lord it over people, or otherwise they are unable to do leadership and serve and care for people the way that Jesus did, with a low posture. So here's the blanks. Here's the blanks. If you want to be elevated in leadership, and by the way, Paul the Apostle says it's a good thing to aspire to leadership. It's a good thing. If you desire to be elevated in leadership, you want to be elevated in leadership, here's what Jesus teaches in his doctorate level course. He says, lower yourself to serve like a slave. Lower yourself to serve like a slave. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must first be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must become your slave. So you lower yourself and you serve like a slave, and Jesus says this is how you begin the pursuit of leadership. This is what it looks like. This is how it works. And for some of you, when you hear the word slave, rightly so, it kind of is shocking, because of what we know about the damage and the injustice that slavery causes and has caused. But this does not mean, Jesus is not advocating that you allow yourself to serve in a way where you're willing to be coerced, abused, or treated harshly. Instead, this is what Jesus is teaching. When you serve like a slave, it's a specific way that you serve. It's a very, very unique way to serve. And here's what it means. It means you're willing to say this: I live my whole life to serve others with no need for credit nor a reward. So serve like a slave simply means this: I'm going to live my life as a lifestyle. I'm going to continue to give and serve and lower myself, and I don't need, I don't expect, and I don't want any credit or any reward. And that's what Jesus is trying to teach. So basically, you can see here, serve like a slave eventually means become a parent. That's what he's teaching. No reward, no credit. And all the parents said, that's not fair. So what does this mean? If I'm going to serve like a slave, no credit, no reward, this means that there's a joyful submission to God, and I begin to pray things and mean it like this: God, your will be done. I begin to serve leadership with joy, and I make it a joy for my leaders to be followed by me. It also means that in my own heart, there's a joyful submission to one another, that we, as we function together as a church family, that we have joyful submission to serve whomever God brings into our lives. And Jesus' disciples who aspire to be a leader, they have to serve in joyful submission. So if you're a parent at home, you're a mom or you're a dad, and there's joyful submission that is happening in your own heart, that means you're willing to be the first one to serve your spouse. You're not waiting to be served, you're willing to do the serving. That means that you let yourself be last even after the kids. Now, some of you are like, well, isn't that common? I mean, isn't that just instinctive? I don't think it's instinctive for all parents to allow themselves to be last after the kids. I think for some people that's a shocker. That serving in the home is last, it's low, It's joyful submission to someone else above them. You know how many issues in the home would be healed if each of the adults who believe in Christ took responsibility to lower themselves and serve like a slave? No credit. What else? No reward. And how many of you have experienced this? When you serve that way, who does God do the most work on, right? He's grinding away at our own character and our own hearts when that happens. If you're an employee, you're a boss, you're in management, or maybe even you're just a church member, and this is what this means. Joyful submission means I don't seek a high seat to sit in. I'm not looking for titles and seats. Instead, I'm looking for a way. You want to be promoted, look for a way to put yourself in a low position, like a slave who's serving for no credit, no reward. Now, how does Jesus demonstrate this slavish serving to others? He doesn't just demand it, he demonstrates it. Jesus, this is your next blank in your notes, you've got them there if you're following along. Jesus, the King, made himself the ultimate slave, and he gave his life as a ransom. This is important. If you're new to the Christian faith, this ransom is a big deal. This word ransom is a huge deal. It is a good summary of what the gospel is, and that is this. The word ransom means to let free or to pay the cost. And what that means is there is somebody who is held captive in prison, and whatever the cost of setting them free, Jesus has paid that cost. And we all know, if you're familiar with the book of Romans and the gospel, the wages of sin is what? It's death. It's required of us who are sinful people and selfish people to pay by death with the shedding of blood to somehow appease the justice of God. And here's what happened. We are condemned to die living a death sentence, and Jesus says, I'm going to pay that price. I'm going to endure that sentence, and I'm going to do it on their behalf. And in so doing, he lets you and I out of jail. He lets us out of captivity. He sets all of the captives free. How? He does it because he becomes a ransom and dies a criminal's death in our place. And Jesus, so here's what Jesus is saying. So listen, if you're balking at this idea that you have to serve other people, keep in mind, what it really looks like is the Son of Man came to serve, not be served. And if you're trying to figure out what that looks like, I was obedient unto death, where I paid with my life to set people free who were guilty. And that's what Jesus means when he says, for even the Son of Man came to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many, to set them free. Now, this is how Jesus frees you to serve like a slave. Because let's face it, when Jesus says, hey, I served so dramatically and so lowly, I let myself be crucified. I mean, how many of you don't really jump at that opportunity? You're not like, oh, me. Bitter cup of suffering? Give me two. Give me three. I'll take a refill. Right? Most of us are kind of like, let me think that one over. And the power to serve like this comes by belief. It comes in beholding Jesus. We know who Jesus is and what he did. But then it comes next by belief. And here's what we have to believe. We have to believe that God has already noticed us, that when we were lost, he saw us like a sheep without a shepherd, and he left the 99 and he pursued us. By the way, I hope you know that theologically, you didn't go looking for God. God has always been in pursuit of you by his Holy Spirit and his grace. And secondly, he's promoted you. When you, before you put your trust in Jesus, do you know what we were called? We were called an enemy of God, separated from God with a wall of enmity. But God, in his grace, promoted us when he saved us from a slave to sin to a child of the king. We've already been promoted. He's noticed us, he promoted us, and then he's credited you with the sinless life of Jesus. So the sinless life of Jesus has been credited to you. Get this. He notices us. He's already noticed us. He promoted us. Also, Jesus credits us. And because he already noticed you, because he already promoted you, and because he already credited you, you don't need to be noticed, promoted, or credited by people. You have all the notice, credit, and promotion that you need because the God of the universe has already done it on your behalf. And so here's how Timothy Keller puts it in a book called The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness that I think is a must read. Here's what he says. Because God already loves you and accepts you, I don't have to do things just to build my resume. I do not have to do things to make me look good. I can do things for the joy of doing them. I can help people to help people. Not so I can feel better about myself, not so I can fill up the emptiness, but because he already loves me and he already accepts me. Here's how I put it in my own words. Because oftentimes, world-class authors like Timothy Keller, they need me to read their material and reword it in a way that's easier to understand. And I don't mean that. Here's what he says. Here's what I wrote. When I trust Jesus, I put my trust in Jesus, God promotes me and rewards me. So I'm never in a situation where I need to promote or reward myself. And what that means is I don't just know that this is gospel truth, but I believe it. And when you believe something is true, isn't it true? It changes the way you live. It changes the way your lifestyle is lived. And there's a vivid picture of this as described by Jesus when he's teaching. And what he describes is what it means for us in the end. And here, lastly, in your notes, you have these two blanks. Fill this in. Jesus separates and he rewards the true believers who are identified by serving like slaves. So in the end, Jesus is going to separate and reward. Separate and reward. Well, what does this mean? What does the separation and reward mean? Here's what it means. That the sheep who belong to Jesus, they serve the least, the people who are the lowest, the people who are the neediest, the people who are the most shattered and broken. But there are goats who refuse to serve the needy, the broken, the people whose lives are desperate. And Jesus describes what's going to happen in verse 31 in the book of Matthew chapter 25. Let me read it to you. I think you can follow along here on the screen. But when the Son of Man comes, this is Jesus describing what's going to happen at the end, okay? When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit upon his glorious throne and all the nations will be gathered in his presence and will separate the people as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. How does he know who belonged to him? Here's how he knows. The sheep served in low positions and with low posture. And the ones who didn't belong to him evidence carelessness. They demonstrated abuse of their own authority and position. He goes on to say this. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the creation of the world. And the king will say, I tell you the truth, when you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you were doing it to me. When you refused to help the least of these, my brothers, you were refusing to help me. So here's what Jesus says. In the end, do you know what evidence there is that someone belongs to me? They serve like a slave. They lower themselves to meet the needs, the dramatic needs of people that are broken to pieces, who can't feed themselves, they cannot clothe themselves, they can hardly take care of themselves, but it's my people who've lowered themselves to serve in that capacity. I look forward for the opportunity that you're going to have to hear from a friend of mine who's the CEO at the Rescue Mission, and he's going to be here to share with us on January 31st and discuss how God is leading the Rescue Mission to care for those who are uncared for, to meet the needs of those who are really, genuinely needy. And our church family is full of these kinds of sheep who selflessly serve with no credit and no reward. And you might say, I don't really know who you mean. It's because they serve with no need to be credited or rewarded. It's anonymous care. It's anonymous serving. No credit, no reward. I am so inspired by the way that some of you think of others first, the way that you elevate the needs of other people above yourselves, the way that you continuously ask about and care about what someone else is going through while you're going through something yourself. Now, if you're a true gospel, humble person, the thing that we would remember about meeting you is how much you seem to be totally interested in us, because the essence of gospel humility is not thinking more of myself, or it's not thinking less of myself, it's thinking of myself less. I just don't come to my own mind very often. And we who are true believers will do whatever needs doing, whenever it's needed, and wherever it leads us. When we are Jesus' disciples, imagine this, we are willing to serve people who are down. I use this D-O-W-N to help us categorize. What kinds of people are we talking about when Jesus says, serve like a slave? Here's what he's talking about, people who are distressed. They've been diagnosed with a disease and are battling a life-altering disease. And when somebody is struggling through a disease, haven't you recognized that it disrupts everybody's life, not just theirs? People whose lives have been disrupted by some kind of catastrophe. People who are in distress because they're facing a divorce or struggling through or recovering from a divorce or domestic violence or abuse. Then there's the orphans who are fatherless people. Oftentimes, they're trapped in a foster care system that will generate 90% of all of the crime that occurs within a community is people who are fatherless. The people who lead the statistics of those who eventually take their own lives. They are fatherless orphans. And God says, my people lower themselves. They don't use their positions of authority to protect themselves. They use their positions of authority to serve and love and care and help to make my name famous among these people. And also people who have been widowed. They continue to try to put the pieces back after their life has been shattered and face grief and loneliness and heartache and purposelessness and try to figure out how are they going to get started living their life again. God says, my people, you know, you're going to be able to find them. You're going to find my people right nearby, those who are grieving and suffering. And lastly, there's people who are just needy. They have some new need that has occurred in their life. All different kinds of ways that these needs show up. And haven't you noticed that when you start aging, your needs change, right? Have you noticed that? I mean, I haven't. I haven't gotten into that aging thing quite yet. I've kind of put it off for another 10 years. But as you start to age, haven't you noticed that your needs change? We've identified that there's a group of people within our church family who are 55 years and older whose needs are dramatically changing. And who have found themselves in a part of their own life where they need unique care, and we want to activate and motivate our church family to participate in caring for this demographic of people. And so if you're 55 years old or older, we want to invite you to a brunch next month. And here's what we're going to do with this brunch. We want to engage you in a conversation, connect you with people, and also we want to discover what your needs are as they change, as they evolve, as you find yourself having real needs in your life. We want to know what they are, why, so we can motivate and activate the rest of the church family to help participate in meeting those needs. But it's important that you participate in that so that we can surface the needs that we need to surface to give ourselves a thorough understanding of how we can activate the rest of the church family. And also, we want to feed you. Okay, so if nothing else, if you're at like 55 years old and you're like, well, I'm not really going to that thing because I know I'm not old enough, we will feed you. So maybe you would reconsider. But we would like you to register for this, and you'll be able to register for this next week. We'll give you a very practical way to register. But this is our way of trying to cultivate a church family who is full of servants, who are sheep, who one day will be rewarded by God and entering into this unbelievable kingdom of heaven with God, with Jesus, to dwell together forever among all of the angels for eternity. And the people who do that aren't the ones who've earned their way, they're the ones who've evidenced their way by being servants. Let's pray together. Father,